You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Ayn Rand's Philosophy for Living on Earth by Ben Baer.
Yeah, so happy Independence Day. And having said that, I want to draw your attention to the fact, if you don't know about it, Ankar Gatte gave a talk a number of years ago that you can see on ARI's YouTube channel called Atlas Shrugged, America's Second Declaration of Independence. And I referenced that at the end of the talk yesterday. And it's profoundly true, and it's particularly true of Galt's speech. And so it works out perfectly that we get to talk about this today. I don't think that we're going to be able to fully appreciate why it's a kind of declaration of independence until the second day of the presentation, tomorrow. So be sure to stick around for that. The talk, however, is called Ayn Rand's Philosophy for Living on Earth. Now, many of you probably heard this phrase, philosophy for living on Earth, associated with objectivism. It was actually the working title for a nonfiction treatise that Ayn Rand was working on, never completed, about her philosophy. But I happen to think that it's a perfect title if you were going to give a title for Galt's speech. It would be a perfect title for Galt's speech. And I want to bring out why that's true both today and tomorrow. Yesterday, I talked about Rourke's speech and how Rourke was an exemplar of independence, both in thought and action. And at the end of the talk, I discussed how, for Rourke, it was really important to figure out the truth of his own ideas, not only for the sake of guiding his own life, but he was also serious about ideas insofar as he wanted to understand what ideas moved the world. I think Galt did that himself to an extent when he discovered the principle behind the Dean and then gave his speech at the end of the novel. But what Galt does in his speech is really a tour de force version of the same thing, of trying to understand what ideas move the world on a really grand scale. It's a speech that's primarily about morality. There are a lot of other topics that it touches on, but it's primarily about morality throughout Atlas Shrugged, leading up to this point. Various characters have compared morality to a motive power that moves men. And what I think we're going to see after our 2 days is how that applies for better or for worse. People's moralities move them for better or for worse, and helps them to live on Earth or stops them from being able to live on Earth. So this talk's going to be a very high-level overview of main ideas from Galt's speech. A lot of it is material that I myself really came to appreciate for the first time after having worked on the Atlas Project. There's obviously much more in the speech that we can't cover because it's such a long speech. And so if you want to learn more, I do want to start just by recommending, you know what LeVar Burton always used to say in Reading Rainbow, don't take my word for it. Check out that talk by Ankar Gatte that I mentioned on the Second Declaration of Independence. Check out the class that Ankar Gatte also did, which was a longer class, like a 5 or 6 lecture class, a study of Galt's speech, which is also, there's a version of that as an essay in Robert Mayhew's anthology on Atlas Shrugged. And yes, there's the Atlas Project. So we did 2 episodes, each 2 hours long, so twice as long as I'm going to get. Check that out. Now, let me just do the same thing that I did last time, which is to ask, is there anybody here who has not read Atlas Shrugged? Okay. Now, that you're safe. You're mostly safe. There are I'm going to have many fewer plot spoilers in this presentation. I can't afford to put them in. There's no time. The main plot spoiler is that there is a speech in the novel. There's a guy named Galt who gives it. And if you didn't know that already coming to this conference, I really can't help you too much. Okay. So I want to start us off with a very brief passage from close to the beginning of the speech. I heard a noise. Close to the beginning of the speech. Yes, this is an age of moral crisis. Your moral code has reached its climax, the blind alley at the end of its course. And if you wish to go on living, what you now need is not to return to morality, you who have never known any, but to discover it, Now, the one other spoiler that I will give about this is that the speech that Galt gives is a speech that he is delivering to a collapsing world. And his statement here about an age of moral crisis has to be taken in that context. However, I think there are still many different ways in which this is applicable to our world today, and I'm going to try to bring out some of those. But our world is obviously very different from Galt's world. Our world is not collapsing in the same way that Galt's world is. And if you were at Yaron Brook's talk on rational optimism the other day, you'll know what I'm talking about. As it just so happened, I mean, so Dr. Brook talked about the Steven Pinker book, which I also recommend reading. And I was actually reading it before getting ready for this talk. And I noticed an interesting tidbit from Pinker at the very beginning of the talk. He gives us lots of charts and graphs, most of which are to show the sorts of things that Dr. Brook was talking about how much better the world is getting. However, Pinker, at the beginning, notes a very interesting disparity. He gives us a graph of what he calls news tone. And this is some study that somebody did of New York Times editorials. Using certain kinds of keywords, you could code for optimism or pessimism. Now, this is the New York Times. But what they discovered was, going back, starting in 1945, there's been decreasing news tone, which suggests a deepening kind of pessimism about the state of the world ever since then, leading up to now. And what Pinker finds interesting is that the New York Times and presumably other members of the intellectual elite have this deepening pessimism over the course of the 20th century, in spite of the fact that things seem to be getting so much better. This is a similar graph to the one that Yaron showed. It's a graph of population and the percentage of our population living in extreme poverty. And the green is the portion of people who are not living in extreme poverty. The red is the portion, the rapidly diminishing proportion of people who are. And so, I mean, things are getting better in demonstrable ways, but people are more pessimistic. Why is this? Now, there are, I think, a lot of different reasons that you could give for this, and Pinker suggests several, many having to do with how much news coverage we get of these sorts of things. And those are all, I think, very important contributing factors. But I think there are possibly philosophic factors we have to consider as well. For instance, one of the major forms of pessimism that Pinker himself talks about is the fact that, well, there are a lot of people who say, yeah, people are getting out of poverty, but the rich are getting richer, and the poor are not as rich by comparison, by this relative standard. So worries about inequality. Why is it that people think inequality is a reason to think things are terrible? What is so evil about inequality? That's something I want to come back to, because what it suggests is maybe one of the things behind this disparity is the standards of evaluation that certain people are using, including perhaps intellectual elites at the New York Times, for assessing the state of the world, standards which don't count this as progress. And so, yes, our world is not collapsing in the way that it is in Atlas Shrugged, but there's still, I think, a very real sense in which we are in a moral crisis. And if we want to understand why, we need to look, just like I was suggesting Rourke wants us to do, we need to look at the ideas that other people use. What standards of value do they use to assess the world? And this is one of the things that Galt opens the speech by discussing. And I'll start off calling this conventional morality, but we'll eventually have another name for this. Galt identifies two major concepts of morality at work in the world today. He calls the first the mystical conception of morality. This is what it sounds like. It's the idea that morality is surrendering ourselves to God's whims. And then there's the social conception of morality, the idea that we should surrender ourselves to society's demands. Now, usually, when people try to characterize different viewpoints in our world today, they characterize these as in complete opposition to each other. And people from one camp can't understand people from the other camp. They're in their own little bubbles. But Galt thinks that these two views have a lot in common with each other. And I think it should be obvious to you, even if you haven't read the book, what at least one of the major common assumptions is. So what's an assumption or two that these two views both share in each other, even though they seem to be very different? Both of them are about surrender, right? So they both think morality is about sacrifice of some kind or another, which means morality is not about self-interest. Anything else? Individual self-interest is definitely not considered. Anything else about how these two moral viewpoints claim to know what's moral? Lack of independent thinking, yeah?
It's just something that can't really be, isn't real.
So there's a question about, are these two standards of morality grounded in reason that grasps the world that we live in, right? And these are the two assumptions that Galt says they share in common. Both are about sacrifice. Both think that morality has no real basis in reason. And another way of putting this that relates to the title of the talk is that neither of them are a morality for living on Earth. So the mystical conception is a morality, but it's not for living on Earth. And maybe the social morality thinks of itself as a morality for something on Earth, but it's certainly not a morality for living on Earth. So, and just about every moral viewpoint that you can think of, according to Galt, fits into one of these two views. So then the question is, what is the alternative? And the first third of the speech is concerned with Galt's stating his positive statement of the alternative. And the name that he uses for it is? The morality of life. Yes, this is his alternative to the conventional moralities, which both call for sacrifice. But I want to point out that glimmers of what the morality of life is come up early in the novel before we even get to Galt's speech. And here's the one last spoiler that I will give, but it's a really relatively minor one. There is a scene, I think in part two, early in part two, I can't remember which chapter. It's the one where there's the breakout scene in the mill. Francisco is speaking to Reardon, and Francisco is trying to convince Reardon that he is one of the most moral men alive. And Reardon is baffled by this statement. And what Francisco does is to try to give a kind of inductive argument for why Reardon is moral. And so he goes through a list of traits that are associated with Reardon's work, and he characterizes them in moral terms. So I won't go through all of them, but for example, Reardon has the independence to formulate a new metal. He has the courage to act on his judgment. He has integrity not to yield to those who attack it. He pursues a productive purpose with discipline, and he takes responsibility for his life, and he has pride in doing all of these things. I'm going to come back to this list later, and one thing that this list gives you is that this alternate morality, it's not a total revision of our viewpoints. I mean, some of these are the sorts of moral virtues people often call moral virtues. But at this point, at least in the novel, we don't yet know why these get to be on the list that Francisco gives us. Why do these count as moral virtues? What ties them together? And what grounds them? And that is the main service that is rendered by Galt's speech. Galt has an explanation for this. And I'm going to start off just by giving the just high-level announcement of what that standard is, that Galt also starts by announcing close to the beginning of his speech, and then talk about how he explains what ties these things together. It goes a little something like this. I say there is a morality of reason, a morality proper to man, and man's life is its standard of value. All that which is proper to the life of a rational being is the good. All that which destroys it is the evil. Now, there's a lot to unpack about this, and this is very abstract, and I want to try to unpack it and make it a little less abstract today. But I want to at least start off by giving you, this is the formula that he's going to try to use to tie together those virtues to show what this morality of life is, and that will show what it means to live on earth and what it means to want to live on earth. But we still have to say a lot about how it is this this standard of the life of a rational being ties the virtues together and why, how it is grounded. I want to take what to you might be a slightly new way of organizing the presentation of Galt's explanation. I'm sure you're familiar with, many of you are familiar with the passage, but I think it's underappreciated, and I think that organizing your thinking in terms of this passage is really useful to understanding the content of the morality that Galt presents. And this is the passage I'm talking about. He says, "My morality, the morality of reason, is contained in a single axiom, existence exists, and in a single choice, to live. The rest proceeds from these." I want to try to organize the rest of the presentation today around these two points. One, this axiom, and two, this choice. And part of the reason that I want to do this is because I think both of these play a big role in understanding what this morality is all about. They give a lot of content to it. I want to try to show connections between these points and a lot of the rest of the content. And I think that there are connections that even a lot of longtime fans of Ayn Rand will miss, and that it's important to emphasize. So let's start with the very beginning. Existence is a very good place to start. Existence exists. Now, this comes very early in a speech that's otherwise supposed to be about morality. And I think maybe part of the reason there's a lot of people who read the speech, I won't ask you, who read the book, I won't ask you who you are, and skip the speech, I won't ask you who you are. Maybe part of the reason why they do that is because they're reading this speech about morality that's supposed to connect to the plot of this novel, and all of a sudden he starts talking about metaphysical axioms. And where is this coming from, I suspect many people think, and why does he think it matters? But I think it really does matter. And for those of you who are longtime objectivists and who've studied objectivism for a long time, I know that you're familiar with this existence exists axiom. But one thing that I've learned a lot about this year from Ankar Gatte in his year two of the OIC is just how important morality is to the metaphysical axioms. These axioms are in there. This whole branch of philosophy of metaphysics is in there because of the role that it plays in understanding and formulating morality. And I want to try to show why that's true. So what does this mean? I mean, on the face of it, existence exists. It just means there's a world out there. It's really real. Facts are what they are. And it's a closely related point to the law of identity, to A is A. And he puts these two points together by saying existence is identity. To be is to be something specific. There's no non-specific being. And he illustrates it. He says a leaf cannot be a stone at the same time. It cannot be all red and all green at the same time. It cannot freeze and burn at the same time. A is A. Or if you wish it stated in simpler language, you cannot have your cake and eat it too. Things have identity, and you can't just strip their identity away from their existence and expect the existence to still be there. That's a really important point for understanding a lot of the rest of what he has to say about human existence. I think many of you who've read The Virtue of Selfishness and The Objectivist Ethics are probably familiar with a number of the points I'm about to go through about the nature of living things and the nature of human life. And that is, of course, indispensable to the argument. But for today, at least, I want to try to file all of that under the heading of the existence axiom. Because what Galt is doing in going through all those facts is he's naming specific facts about the identity of human existence. So what are some facts? We're living things. And an important fact about the identity of living things is that their existence depends upon a specific course of action. They constantly face the alternative of existence or non-existence, life or death. And they only remain in existence to the extent that they pursue a very specific path with very specific identity. And when you get to human beings, there's what is our specific path? What's the specific identity of human life? Well, our life depends upon the use of the rational mind. Reason is our basic means of survival. We're not born with any claws or fangs. It's our minds that allow us to thrive. And not only that, but our minds have a very specific identity as well. In particular, and this is the next big point, we have to choose to use them. They don't work automatically. We are not deterministic robots. We have free will. And one thing that we'll see, especially in the next section, is that what it means to be rational, which is our means of human survival, is to accept the facts of existence. So when Galt is talking about embracing the axiom of existence, it's code for being rational. Rationality means accepting the facts for what they are and accepting them in all of their specific identity. And that's going to be a point I'll keep echoing, especially because of the fact that Galt emphasizes at one point that all the disasters that have wrecked the world come from your leader's attempt to evade the fact that A is A. The purpose of those who taught you to evade it was to make you forget that man is man. So you sometimes hear the criticism that this A is A point is just a trivial tautology, completely empty, has no philosophic significance. What's the point? You can't deduce anything from it. But for such a trivial axiom, it is interesting how many people evade it when they talk about, for example, ethics. So I've just listed a few really crucial points about the nature of human existence, about the identity of human existence. Having stated that, can you think of any philosophical or moral viewpoints that evade these facts about human nature? That evade the fact that we are living things that have to pursue a specific course of action, that have to use our minds to live, that that's what human life consists of? Anybody think of any examples? What's that?
The two alternatives.
Well, let's see if we can come up with concrete examples of that. So for example, who is it that says, of those two viewpoints, who is it that says if you've got someone, let's say, who's existing in a persistent vegetative state, and they're just hooked up to machines, but they've got a heartbeat, we shouldn't unplug them because we need to respect the sanctity of human life? That's a religious viewpoint. So that's the mystical conception of morality, the idea that there's something sacred just in the beating of a heart, and something that has a certain kind of DNA. Or talk about the abortion debate, right? The fetus or the embryo has certain kind of cells in it, and that's what makes it sacred. That's what makes it a human life. Well, not on the view that Galt is recommending here. What makes something distinctively human is its use and possession of a rational mind. That's our existence. And viewpoints that say human life is something other than those, it's something non-specific, they're evading that fact. Or if you say, for instance, that human life is just about maximizing certain sensations of pleasure and avoiding pain, who says that? Utilitarianism, which is a version of the social conception of morality, which is not taking account of, and this is a bit of a simplification, but we can come back to it, is not taking account of the fact that, no, human life consists in more than just being the recipients of pleasures and pains. It's more than just being a couch potato, basically. So there are viewpoints out there that assimilate human life to the life of a vegetable, either in the vegetative state form or the vegetable that grows in a potato patch on your couch. And we're going to get to even bigger and more important, I think, versions of views that rebel against human identity on the second day when we get to Galt's understanding of the deeper understanding of those conventional moral viewpoints. Okay. So that's a lot of stuff I think you should file under the heading of the existence axiom. That's one of the two big points. Let's look at the other one, the choice to live. So we said something about existence. That's one of the big metaphysical axioms in objectivist metaphysics. As many of you know, there's a second. Existence exists, and consciousness is the faculty that perceives existence. Human consciousness itself has a very important specific identity, and I already mentioned it. That's the fact that human consciousness is volitional. There are all kinds of choices that we have to make to use our consciousness, to use our minds to survive. If we know what we need to do to survive, we have to choose to act on that knowledge. But guess what? We don't come born with that knowledge to begin with. We have to choose to acquire it or not in the first place. And guess what? We're not even born knowing how to acquire that knowledge. We have to figure out how to learn things. We have to learn rules of thought, rules of logic. And really, at the bottom of all of this, the fundamental choice that we all have to make is the choice to think at all or not in order to discover all of these things that I've just mentioned. Now, it's worth pointing out the connection that if what the fundamental alternative is to open up your mind to the facts or not, to be rational or not, then another way of glossing this is to call it the choice to accept existence or not. And that connects this point back to the first axiom. But there's another way of describing what it means to accept existence or not. What would you call that? To live, to accept life or not, to the choice to think or not, it really does come down to the same thing as the choice to live or not. And so even though these two points, existence and the choice to live, are separate points, there's all kinds of interconnections between the two of them. And I'll continue to remind you of some of them going forward. Having stated all of these points, Galt then goes on to point out, look, morality is precisely a code of values that you need to guide your choices. If we didn't have this second point, if we didn't talk about the choice to live, if we only had, there's a bunch of facts about human nature, we survive through certain means, that would be all very well and good and interesting, but it wouldn't yet give us any grounds for a moral code, because morality is about guiding your choices. And so it's essential to point out all the choices that we have to make before getting to what it is to say that certain things are morally right or morally wrong, that certain choices are the ones that you ought to give or ought not to give. Without these choices, morality has no point to it. It doesn't give you any reasons. It doesn't have any meaningful content. Any meaningful statement about what you ought to do, in Rand's view, and I'll show you a passage to this effect in a moment, has to be taken in conjunction with the conditional statement. You ought to do something if you want to live, if you choose to accept the realm of existence. And in case that the significance of this point isn't clear to you, it's worth, again, looking at what other viewpoints say, what these other conventional viewpoints say. Can you think of any particular ethical viewpoints that don't accept the role of choice in morality, that deny the choice, that we need choices like that to make sense of what we ought to do or not?
Calvinism?
Calvinism is a really explicit form because they say we're all predestined. But broader than that?
Determinism.
Any kind of determinism, for sure. But when we're thinking about moral commandments, I mean, religion usually is put in the form of thou shalt or thou shalt not. Just period, right? It's not thou shalt if you want to live. It's just 'cause. And there's a particular slightly more secularized version of this viewpoint that is much discussed by objectivists. It's a viewpoint that says you have these categorical imperative obligations. Who's this, of course? And that's Kant. And I just want to point out, maybe you caught the reference that Dr. Salmieri made in his talk yesterday. Someone asked about Catherine Halsey, and he said you should look up this person, Maria von Herbert, who was a correspondent with Kant. And I did that last night. And it's a remarkable and tragic story. I don't know if any of you did it, but basically this woman's a young student of Kant's living in Austria. She's read all his books. She's lost a lover. She's clinically depressed. And she writes a letter to Kant saying, I don't want to live. Can you give me any reason to live in your philosophy? And he can't. And she kills herself. Now, of course, there's no real reason that you can give, you know, to somebody who doesn't really want to live. But the point is that for Kant, and what's interesting about this is for Kant, his morality, he thinks that his morality gives all kinds of reasons. But since they're not actually connected to our choices, there's really nothing that he can say. And I do suggest Googling her name, and there's a journal article that comes up about it, which is fascinating to read. Maria von Herbert.
Explain the categorical
if we have time, yeah. Okay. So I do want to move on, though, to talk a little bit more about what to say about those who do not want to live, because Galt speaks to it explicitly at one point. He says, no, you do not have to live. It is your basic act of choice. But if you choose to live, you must live as a man, by the work and the judgment of your mind. This first passage really does, I think, emphasize the hypothetical nature of moral obligation, that it's dependent on choice. If you choose to live, you must live as a man. It's not just, you must live. There is no commandment to live. But let me show you the very next passage. No, you do not have to live as a man. It is an act of moral choice. But you cannot live as anything else. And what I want to emphasize here is, again, how important it is to take all of this in the context of what he said about the existence axiom. Existence is identity. There is no being of non-specific nature. Everything that exists has a specific nature. And what it is to live as a human being is to pursue certain very definite activities, a very specific course of life. If you don't choose to be rational, what he's saying is don't pretend that what you're doing is living a human life, because you're not then respecting the identity of what it means to do that. Anything less than rationality, than full rationality, is something less than a full human life. And I want to take this back for a moment to the conversation between Reardon and Francisco, where Francisco is trying to explain to Reardon why he is one of the most moral men. And I gave you that list of virtues. And I said, well, these sound like the sorts of things that we call moral virtues. So there's some rhetorical power to what Francisco is saying. But there's still an unanswered question about, well, why do these count as moral virtues, and what grounds them, and what connects them together? And we now can start to see what that is when we look at Galt's speech and what I've just been discussing. Because one of the things that Galt emphasizes about these same exact virtues is that they are aspects of rationality. And we know he's saying rationality is the distinctive human form of existence, the human form of living. You'll notice whenever he describes each of these virtues, he always begins by saying, they are recognitions of the fact that, blank. And then he names a fact. And what is it to recognize facts? It's to accept existence, right? So here are a few examples. I won't go through all of them. But Reardon, they're all specific aspects of rationality, ways of accepting important facts. The fact of independence, which we spent a lot of time talking about yesterday. This is the fact that you have to do your own thinking, that nobody else can do it for you. Just as you cannot, someone else can't digest their food for you, you have to digest your own knowledge. And this connects to the fact that we all have free will, and that's what separates us from other people. And this is This is distinctive for human beings. There are other living creatures that don't have free will, and they are a lot more connected to each other than we are because of that. And you can make a case for collectivism if you're talking about a school of fish or a beehive or ants in a way that you can't for human beings. Integrity is recognizing the fact that thinking is for the sake of acting, that it's not just for having fantasies in your mind that are going to swim around and you're not going to do anything with. Productiveness, and this is Reardon's most exemplary virtue, is it recognizing the fact that living requires reshaping matter to achieve our purposes. Now, I want to ask you a question which, the answer to which I think a lot of people sometimes find confusing, but if you can get clear on it, it'll help you see how a lot of the points we've been talking about are connected to each other. Is virtue, so these are examples of moral virtues. Is virtue a means to an end or an end in itself? So raise your hand if you think virtue is a means to an end. Raise your hand if you think it's an end in itself. So a few people say end in itself. Most of you said means to an end. Now, I don't think that people who said means to an end are wrong. But what's interesting to talk about here is whether accepting that point implies virtue's only a means to an end. Can it be both of these things? And I think understanding how it can be both is really important for understanding the content of this morality, and especially for connecting it back to the metaphysical axioms. Think for a moment, if you will, change the topic from human life to the life of a pig. And this is something the utilitarians like to talk about, but think about the pig and its consciousness, which is a pig has to survive by its consciousness as well. It doesn't have a rational consciousness, but it has to be able to see things, to seek out its food. Is its consciousness a means to its life, or is it part of the end of its life? Think about what happens if you take that pig to the slaughterhouse, and you zap it, let's say, humanely. The pig's brain is going to die immediately. It will lose its consciousness. Now, it's a pretty good bet that even still, there's a lot left in that pig that's still alive in some sense. The cells of the pig are probably alive as long as there's still a little bit of blood running through it. It's a good bet that when you pick up a pork chop at the grocery store, there's still a few cells that are alive. But the point is that even that immediately after you kill the pig's brain, even though there's lots of living cells in its body, it's dead as a pig. It has lost its life as a pig. There are the lives of its individual cells, but pig qua pig is gone. And the same thing is basically true about human beings. Suppose that you take, you want to do something similar to yourself. I don't recommend this. suppose you chirogenically freeze yourself, right? So that each and every one of the molecules of your body is perfectly preserved in some freezer somewhere, probably in Silicon Valley. So your body's perfectly intact. Everything's going to stay in existence, maybe till the end of time because of whatever device Elon Musk gives us, right? Still, you're dead, right? Your consciousness has gone out of existence. Your rational mind has stopped working, and no matter what you say about your body, your mind is gone, and so is your life. And I think that's a good way of illustrating the point that our minds are not just, they're not just a tool, they're not just a means to the end of what it is to live as a human being. They're part of the end. Sometimes you hear the idea life is an end in itself. That comes up more later in the Objectivist Ethics. What does it mean to say life is an end in itself? It's not that you get to some end state at the end of your life and now you're frozen in carbonite and you've reached the end. It's that what it means to say life is an end is that it's a series of actions that are means to the end of more of themselves. And what are those actions? What actions make a human being a human being? Well, they're very specific actions with a very specific identity, and the actions that distinguish us from living entities are the actions of our rational mind. And so part of what it means to live as a human being is to use our rationality, is to accept these facts, is to accept existence. Rationality is both a means and an end. Yeah?
Can you repeat that line? It's a series of actions that support the next step.
Part of what it means to say that life is an end in itself is to say there's a series of actions that are means to the ends of more of themselves. Well, I'm glad that you asked that, because that's the very next point. So if you don't believe me that this is a viewpoint Ayn Rand is articulating in Galt's speech, if you don't agree that she's saying rationality is both a means to the end of life and also part of the end, take a look at these passages from Galt's speech. He says, "In any hour and issue of your life, you are free to think or to evade that effort. But you are not free to escape from your nature, from the fact that reason is your means of survival, so that for you who are a human being, the question to be or not to be is the question to think or not to think." So he's not saying that thinking or not thinking helps you to be or not be, though that's true. He's saying to be or not to be is to think or not to think. And here's even a little bit more, and this speaks specifically to the question that just came up. Non-thinking is an act of annihilation, a wish to negate existence, an attempt to wipe out reality. But existence exists. Reality is not to be wiped out. It will merely wipe out the wiper. You probably remember that point, but look at the rest. By refusing to say it is, that is, by refusing to think, refusing to accept reality, you are refusing to say I am. And even more, by suspending your judgment, you are negating your person. When a man declares, who am I to know, he is declaring, who am I to live? Now, the viewpoint here is not that the moment that you stop thinking, you're dead. But it is that to the extent that you stop thinking, to that extent, you are not living a fully human life. And this is not just an issue of means and end. It's an issue of you're not participating in the end, the specific identity of what human existence is. And this gets even clearer, by the way, in the Objectivist Ethics, in an underappreciated passage where Ayn Rand says that the cardinal values and major virtues are not just means to, but they are realizations of the end of life. So I'm going to wrap up in a moment here, but I do want to, without saying a lot, just acknowledge the fact that this view about virtue and this view of the morality of life has a lot of implications for social morality, for how it is that we deal with other people, that it follows basically the same pattern as we've just been discussing, that Galt says, do you ask what moral obligation I owe to my fellow men? By the way, the philosophy professor who I just commented on in the New Ideal Post quotes this part in her article. What obligation do I owe? None, she ends the quote. Doesn't read the rest. Except the obligation I owe to myself, to material objects, and to all of existence, rationality. I deal with men as my nature and theirs demands by means of reason. I seek or desire nothing from them except such relations as they care to enter of their own voluntary choice. So this is, of course, the transition to laying the groundwork then for the idea that force is evil, that our only right is to be free from force, and that, of course, lays the foundation for a view of individual rights and purpose of government. I'm not going to go into that today. But, I mean, the essence of it is, look, you choose rationality in order to create values in the world. If you want to benefit from the values of others, you need to respect their rationality as well. You need to respect the fact that they need to be able to respect the facts. So I want to now go back to close. I want to mention one last part of the scene between Francisco and Reardon. At one point, after having made his kind of inductive case for why Reardon is one of the most moral men, Francisco nonetheless acknowledges not everybody thinks that. And people are attacking Reardon. And here's what Francisco says. He says, you have been paying blackmail, not for your vices, but for your virtues. You have been willing to carry the load of an unearned punishment and to let it grow the heavier, the greater the virtues you practiced. But your virtues were those which kept men alive. Your own moral code, the one you lived by, but never stated, acknowledged, or defended, was the code that preserves man's existence. If you were punished for it, what was the nature of those who punished you? Yours was the code of life. What then is theirs? What standard of value lies at its root? What is its ultimate purpose? She knows. So we've talked about the morality of life, and this, I think, is a good transition to what we're going to talk about next time, which is what that other code is and what standard of value lies at its root. And I think it's going to help us understand that anecdote that I started with from Pinker about why there's this disparity between the way certain intellectuals estimate the nature of the world and the facts that we observe. They've got different standards than the morality of life. And what standards would those be? What kind of standard is it that says, even though everybody's getting better, it's terrible because some people are getting even better than others? This inequality idea. So we will talk next time about basically Galt's answer to this question, to Francisco's question, what then is the value, the standard of value at the root of this conventional morality of sacrifice? And I should say, I think this section of the speech we'll discuss is underappreciated by many objectivists, the end where he talks about this other code. So I hope to see you tomorrow. Let's talk.
So I'm starting to formulate the answer to this in my mind, but I'm having a hard time. Speaking to people in my life, or to people this passage refers to, who claim, but I'm still alive and I'm not living by this system of values that you're talking about. How would you respond to that? They're like, oh, I'm a devout Christian and I seem to be living a happy life.
Okay, well, I mean, there's a couple of things. Let me start with the slightly less important issue, which is that there can be Christians who are living happy lives, right? Just the viewpoints that somebody professes doesn't necessarily tell you about the values they're actually living by. And this is precisely one of Reardon's issues, right? That what Francisco is saying, the code that you actually live by is different from the code that you acknowledge. You live according to a code of life. You don't realize that. And you feel this unnecessary guilt because you've internalized this other code but that you're not acting on. So it's more than possible that the kind of person you're talking to is in a position that's similar to Reardon. They could be living according to the morality of life but not acknowledging that, and that there is that it's not ideal. They need, because you're going to face that kind of guilt, you're going to face this kind of tension if you do that. But then the second point is, let's suppose they're not really living according to the morality of life. Well, yeah, they're not just a corpse, for sure. But they're living less of a human life than they could be. And they're moving in the direction of non-existence. And the question that you should ask them is, why would you want to do that?
Also, sleeping. Are you dead as a human when you're sleeping? Or a boxer gets knocked out and he's laying down like, oh, I just killed
him. I mean,
it's
part of the identity of most every mammal and other higher animals that you have to sleep. So that's something we share in common with animals. That's just part of what it means to be a living thing of any kind. And that's consistent with being a rational living thing, I would say.
Also depends when you're sleeping.
Yes. Hopefully not now.
So Ben, is like the whole theme of this talk, is this pretty much what Ayn Rand meant when she talked about the whole is-ought or like dichotomy or kind of meta-ethics, like how you derive morality from metaphysical principles? Is that kind of the
definitely
theme?
Yeah, I mean, so the two points that I dwelled on, the existence axiom and the choice to live, those are the two big facts that you need to base your ought on an is. And something that I think goes underappreciated is that the first point is not enough. It's not enough just to talk about the nature of living things and how they face the alternative of existence and the non-existence and how there's certain things they need in order to live. that tells us something about values by itself, because living things other than human beings, you can talk about things being good or bad for them, but if you really want to get to the crux of the issue, you want to talk about moral value, and for that you need to talk about the choice to live and about how moral obligations are conditional on that choice, and that's really important to understanding their content. So in philosophy, there are people who try to ground facts on values, and sometimes they're called naturalists, sometimes they're called moral realists. Many of the criticisms that other philosophers subject them to when they say this doesn't really work, interestingly point in the direction that you need more, that you need something like the human conscious perspective that comes through the choice to live. And so sometimes I want to say, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but there's a school of philosophy called non-cognitivism, which says you can't just reduce it to facts and existence. There has to also be something about human consciousness. There's a respect in which that's what this viewpoint is. But that doesn't mean that the first part isn't there. That doesn't mean that the facts about biology and so forth aren't relevant. They totally are.
Interesting. Thank you.
Good morning, Dr. Baer. I was wondering about the virtues. Virtue as a means to an end. I was thinking, that's why I raised my hand when you asked that question. It's virtues are means to like the end of values, correct? In order to have values, you need virtues. Could you expound upon that?
I mean, that's definitely true. And if you look, for example, in the Objectivist Ethics, she talks about how the virtue of rationality is a means to the end of the value of reason, and the virtue of productiveness is a means to the end of the value of purpose, and the virtue of pride is a means to the end of the value of self-esteem. And reason, purpose, and self-esteem are these cardinal values. And that's all true. There are certain mental actions, virtue's a kind of action, that you need to engage in order to achieve other certain ends. But the point that I'm trying to make is simply that that's not the end of the story, that reason, purpose, and self-esteem are values. They're also values for something, just like any value, right? And so they're means to some further end. And it's a virtuous cycle. And what human life is pursuing these means to ends which are themselves complementary to the pursuit of further ends, so it's an ever-growing virtuous cycle moving forward. And that's what all living things do.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a pretty simple question about the meaning of life. I've taught the Objectivist Ethics and courses on the meaning of life and philosophy of life, death, and dying, and the students find this very intriguing in a lot of ways, but they always crash on the claim about the choice to live is in some sense being a premoral choice. And they wonder, well, does that mean that you can't give me a reason to live if I'm seriously contemplating suicide? Usually something, most people, that's not an issue because they're already involved in a flow of life projects that they find valuable. Mm-hmm. And they don't question that because they've already embraced their existence and value is intertwined. But for people who are shaken up, they wonder, is there anything that this view can say to reconnect them to their source of value or meaning? How would you respond to that? I was being facetious.
Tricky one. So I mean, what I said in the talk was that there is an important sense in which there is nothing that you can say. Someone has to choose to live for themselves. But there's another sense, I think, in which there are things you can say and things you can point to. And what's crucial is that, I mean, they're not going to force anybody to accept them, but you can point to the things in life that can make life worth living for those who accept them, forms of pleasure and happiness that are possible. And they may or may not want to look at them, but in a lot of ways, this is more of a psychological question than a philosophical one, so I don't want to get too much into it, but I do recommend strongly, there's an essay in the volume 2 of the Ayn Rand Society Philosophical Studies, volume 1, the one on egoism, on meta-ethics, yeah. And the first essay in that book by Daryl Wright, which is called Reasoning About Ends, is really good on this topic, especially toward the end where he talks about the sense in which you can have a reason for accepting life, and it has a lot to do with these kinds of examples.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi. In regards to talking to the layman about this kind of stuff, let's say someone asks you, well, why do you think this, and you don't have the time to go into your morality and your epistemology, would saying, well, I don't believe that the world owes you anything and I don't owe the world anything, would that be an appropriate kind of short response, or should that be qualified with something, or is it just a completely, like, should that kind of line of reasoning be avoided?
So the question is, if you are trying to
encapsulate
your moral philosophy to someone who doesn't already accept it, is saying something about not having responsibilities to others and they're not having responsibilities to me, that's a way to do it? I would say that's not enough, because mm-hmm. it's too negative. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an implication. Like, I read the passage that we just looked at about social morality, and notice he's not just stating the negative. He's not saying, I don't have any obligations to you. He says, I don't have any except rationality, mm-hmm. except offering to trade value for value in exchange for yours, and respecting your rationality. And that's just the social morality component of this, right? I spent a smaller amount of time on this because it's the less important part of the speech. The more important part is the virtues that you need to live your own life. Recognizing all the facts that are required for human life and applying them to your specific individual life and the purpose of your own life. So I would recommend folks focusing much more on the positive and much more on the content that relates to man qua man.
Okay. Thanks.
Hmm? So there's values to achieve in one's life that still constitute your life. For instance, like sleeping, you're not necessarily completely dead. There's things like nutrition, health and fitness, the fact that we're communal animals but independent thinkers. And so I'm curious, if you're outlining kind of what are things that are valuable to a man, how do you organize those things? Like, yes, we need to think to live, like make money so that we can buy food, so that we can stay fit and healthy. How do you organize those things into your philosophy?
Good. I mean, it's a hard question to answer, but I think that it's useful to look at the way that Ayn Rand does it, which is, I mean, yeah, you could list lots of different things that we need for life. And like everybody needs food, but she doesn't mention food in particular. Because part of what she's doing is she's saying, well, what does philosophy have to say about what we need for life? And where philosophy starts is with these metaphysical axioms of existence and consciousness. And something that I've especially come to appreciate over the last year of sitting in on some of Ankar Gatte's classes is the extent to which all of these virtues that she discusses, they're all particular glosses on important relationships between existence and consciousness. And those facts about existence and consciousness that are fundamental to life for everybody. So that's the philosopher's job in this respect. Organize the content of the morality along the lines of the fundamentals of philosophy. And that's part of the reason in this talk I was really trying to emphasize how you have to take the ethics in the context of that metaphysics. And the metaphysics is there for the sake of the ethics. It's not there so that we can catalog all the kinds of entities there are in the universe as an exercise in erudition. It's there for living.
So it's a philosophy says we need to think to live, and then it's the individual's job to say, I need these things to live, so I'll organize priorities around those in my life.
And the way that these principles apply to different people is going to vary from person to person, but the principles designate a range within which human life is possible, outside of which it's not.
Got it.
I think we have time for one more.
Okay, Ben, awesome, and I really appreciate everything you've shared with us. I could sit here all day and listen. I want to pull back and sort of take in a more sort of evolutionary look at man. Qua man, and
assuming that Rand's morality is the truth, that is, she has identified what it is we do need to do in order to live for life. When did this begin? You know, I mean, was it 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago? I know we can't put a, but do you see what I'm getting at? I'm trying to figure out, at some point it must have been that the morality for life, man qua man, was much more communal or collective or whatever, because we were apes in the trees, right? And so sometimes I really get caught up in wondering, okay, is this morality here for the duration, or are we going to then, are we going to need to tweak it as we go along, as we evolve as a species?
So in many ways, I think this is a question for a paleoanthropologist to answer, and I am not one, so I'll punt on that. I mean, it's a question about when do the human species first emerge as a distinctive species.
Right.
That's above my pay grade. But the one thing I will add to that is that even if you figure out when that was, it's still not necessarily the case that the morality of life is going to be applicable in an obvious way, because obviously somebody had to figure this out on some level before it could be applicable. Now, it was applicable before Ayn Rand wrote about it in Atlas Shrugged. This is based on facts that people have been able to grasp for many centuries.
Right.
And to that extent, they would have had some implicit understanding of that morality. When that is, I don't know.
Thank you for taking
that's
a stab.
That's also a historian's job.
Right, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.